Filmmaker Werner Herzog is one of the directors who reestablished Germany as a major force in cinema after its movie industry was decimated by Hitler and World War II. Herzog was born in 1942. Like the Dieter Dengler story told in his new film Rescue Dawn, many of Herzog's movies have been about physical and emotional extremes, often involving enigmatic characters struggling against seemingly impossible odds. His film Aguirre, the Wrath of God is about a mad Spanish conquistador. Fitzcarraldo follows a man obsessed with building an opera house in the jungle. In 1998, Terry spoke to Herzog about his first film based on Dieter Dengler, the documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Dengler was a German-born U.S. Navy pilot who was shot down during the war in Vietnam, then imprisoned and tortured in Laos. In this scene from the documentary, Dengler describes the day he escaped.
I ran out in the open. Nobody came from this side except the guards. They're running in my direction. I must have heard or seen the other guys. And this big shootout started. All of a sudden, the bullets were flying. Somehow we had miscalculated. Somebody had a rifle in there. I had this submachine gun in my hand. I'd never shot one before. When I pulled the trigger, it practically flew out of my hand. It raised up like that, and this allowed them to close this distance real quick. They came within 2 or 3 feet for me. The moron, one of the guys, had a machete in his hand. He came within 4 or 5 feet. I shot him through the hip. It lifted him up. It threw him down to the ground. Next thing I'm looking up, he's getting up again. He still had the machete. He's still coming at me. Of course, this time I couldn't miss. He was right 2 or 3 feet in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I didn't have a scratch. There's 5 dead guards laying on the ground. 2 of them got away. They ran a zigzag pattern. They got in the jungle. I knew then, right then and there, they would get help, and we had to get out of there. Where was Dwayne? I saw him behind this bush over here. He had vomited. I yelled to him, Dwayne, let's get out here. Let's get out of here. We took off. We ran down between this kitchen. We ran amongst those dead guys laying on the ground. And it was very important because our shoes were tied together in a bundle. We're hanging on this hut over here. The shoes we needed in the jungle, but when we got there, they were already taken. The other guys must have taken them, run off with them. And then Dwayne and I, we had no choice but to turn around. Barefoot, we ran into the jungle. Out of the 7 of us that escaped, I was the only one that came out alive. The other one disappeared in the jungle, and nobody ever heard from them again.
Dieter Dengler's escape was filled with hellish adventures, including surviving a monsoon without any protection. Terry asked Herzog how he thought Dengler was changed by his experience.
I do believe that he was not very much changed because he had a very difficult and hard childhood, and that somehow linked me together with him immediately. Both of us grew up in tiny rural villages in rural areas, remote from everything. We didn't know what TV was, what a telephone was. I made my first phone call at the age of 17. And he knew hunger, and he knew all the hardships of growing up as a post-war child. And I do believe that he was extremely well prepared, better than anyone else that I would know for an ordeal of that nature. He had all the qualities that make America so wonderful, the qualities of self-reliance, courage, spirit of some sort of a frontier, and all those things.
You brought him back to the jungle and had him simulate some of the scenes that he lived through when he was in the prison camp. It seems like it was almost masochistic on his part to agree to that.
Not really, because he felt very much at ease with this whole thing. Fact is that he has been at least 15 times before we made the film back to the jungle, back to Southeast Asia. He loves Asian people. He loves the qualities, the human qualities of his former enemies. And that may be the only change, to come back to the previous question. He changed his attitude about the opponent, about the enemy, the Vietnamese, the Laotians. He had no concept of who they were. I mean, he started in the war very, very early in 1965, where nobody really talked about Vietnam, and he thought it would be over in 3 weeks, that they just had to assist some South Vietnamese generals to stop a few insurgents from the north. And in his first mission over North Vietnam, he was actually shot down after 40 minutes. So he didn't really capture what the war was all about. once he was down on the ground, the entire country was not an abstract grid on a map anymore. It was, all of a sudden, it was filled with voices, with human beings, with people who were starving, people who were under pressure of air attacks and all this. And almost immediately he started to change his attitude, to understand that there were real people down there, real suffering down there, real death down there.
He seems to be very obsessive in his descriptions of the past, obsessed with what is required to survive. And he's almost a survivalist now. I mean, you have him saying that he keeps hundreds of pounds of grains in his house in case of emergency because he knows what it's like to be without food. And watching the movie, I kept wondering, was this guy really obsessive before his imprisonment, or did he become obsessive as a result of his imprisonment? And I know that you are very interested in obsession and are probably pretty obsessive yourself, so I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
I wouldn't really call him obsessive.
No.
Of course, he has been changed by all these experiences, and he feels much safer to have 1,100 pounds of rice and 1,000 yeah. pounds of flour under his kitchen floor dug into the ground. Sure, that is understandable. And he has developed certain safeguards. He's a very wholesome man, a very healthy human being. Sometimes I have the feeling he's hiding his wounds, and he's hiding the terror behind some very casual remarks. I would, for example, ask him in private, Dieter, don't you have any nightmares of that time? Is there nothing left? And he says, oh, that was the fun part of my life. So we can only sense that there's still some open wounds within the man, but he's not collapsing and not struggling for his sanity and all those things that you might have seen among many of the Vietnam veterans who came home and who were innerly destroyed.
How come you've been making so many documentaries? I know you've made documentaries on and off through your career, but it seems to be, well, exclusively what you're doing now.
It's not the exclusive thing I'm doing now. Once in a while, I stage operas. I love to live and breathe and work with music. But it is true, in the last couple of years, I've only done documentaries, and that was a development, a deep question about filmmaking, probably about writing or art in general. What constitutes truth in, for example, a great poem? When you read Robert Frost and you have some very deep feeling about it, and all of a sudden you have this sensation there is some deep, inexplicable and mysterious truth in it. And the same thing happens in movies. And it does not happen, strangely enough, in the most of the documentaries that you would see on television. You would not find it in the so-called cinema vérité, which can only scratch the surface of what is truth. It's the accountant's truth. It's the bookkeeper's truth. And yet, I have been for years after the question, how can you dig into a very deep stratum of truth, into something inexplicable, something mysterious? And, of course, you can reach it and you can find it, but normally through invention, through imagination, through fabrication, sometimes even contorting and stylizing events right out there. And then all of a sudden, you will find something strange and deep and elusive, and that is a certain truth. And you must not make the mistake to believe that everything in Little Dieter Needs to Fly is the accountant's truth. Much of it has been invented. His dreams are my invention. Or, for example, there's a scene where he tries to explain how death looks like for him. And he's standing in front of a tank with jellyfish in it, a water tank. And he simply tried to explain it to me, what death was looking like for him, and he had no image, and he described it in a way that I immediately figured it was jellyfish slowly moving, almost dancing in a void, and in a slow motion, transparent, strange movement. And that was exactly what was needed. He only couldn't express it, but I had the image for it.
My guest is film director Werner Herzog. You were born in 1942 and grew up in Germany in the very end of the war and in the post-war period. I'm wondering what your early memories are of the war or the post-war period.
I do have clear memories of that time. You have to imagine that when I was born in Munich, only 2 weeks later, a bomb hit the house next to us. And our place was half destroyed, and my mother discovered me, the baby, under a foot of shards of glass and debris. But I was unhurt, but my mother fled to the remotest mountain valley in Bavaria, and we got stuck there. So by the age of 11, I had no idea what a telephone was. I had never seen movies. I'd never seen a TV set. I barely had seen cars in my life, and you may not believe this, but I made my first phone call at the age of 17, but I made my first movie at the age of 19. So that explains a little bit about the background. And of course, I remember the hardships, and I remember that I was hungry as a child and we had nothing to eat and things like this, which was quite all right because I had a wonderful childhood, and I wouldn't like to miss that.
Filmmaker Werner Herzog speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Werner Herzog. His new feature film is Rescue Dawn.
You are very interested as a filmmaker in unusual and sometimes surrealistic kind of landscapes and extreme landscapes, whether it's, you know, it's the jungle or the desert, or a bombed-out area. And I'm wondering if you had a lot of visual images like that kind of imprinted in you in the post-war era when Germany was so bombed out.
No, I belong to those Germans who didn't have a childhood image of the post-war Germany, because in this mountain village there was no real warfare. It was just occupied by 60 Americans at the very, very end of the war. It was the last pocket of unoccupied territory when Germany shrank more and more and more. All of a sudden, this was the last remaining unoccupied square mile or whatever. And 60 Americans moved in jeeps, and they were totally relaxed, chewing gum. And I had the feeling this was all the Americans of the world. And for the first time, I saw a black man. And I was totally mesmerized by seeing him because I had only heard about black people in fairy tales. And I immediately became friends with him and talked to him for hours. So what I want to say is the climate was not the climate of total destruction that Germany had witnessed all around me. It was a mountain village, a mountain valley, remote and just nature around. And only when I was 11 and the war was well over, I saw destroyed cities and bombed out places, and I developed a concept of what must have happened.
And were you frightened by that concept?
No, not really. It's strange because everybody thinks that German children who grew up in the post-war time had a terrible childhood. In the contrary, nobody was frightened. All my school friends who grew up in the cities, they are delirious about speaking of this time when they grew up in ruins, and it was pure anarchy in the best sense of the word. There were no fathers around to tell them what to do and how to do things. They would be the masters and the kings of, let's say, a whole block that was bombed out, and it was the most wonderful playground for children. Or, for example, in my case, in this last days of war, some soldiers had fled into this area and had hidden their weapons under the hay or in the forest. And by age 4, age 5, I had a working submachine gun. and fired with it. And I tried to hunt a crow because I wanted to make a soup. I was so hungry. And my mother discovered that, and she was totally calm and explained to us how lethal a weapon like that could be by just demonstrating it, by shooting one single round through a thick log of beech wood. And we were so stunned by the violence and force of such a weapon that we immediately had a clear sense how to behave. And it was just learning by experience. And the childhood of practically all the children who grew up in the post-war time was wonderful, as strange and as paradoxical as it may sound.
Now, you did have a father, I believe, and I think you've described him as someone who was a militant atheist, and at 14 you converted to Catholicism. Was that like in reaction against your father?
I do not believe so, because I grew up without the presence of my father.
Oh, I see.
In other words, my father was away in the war, and then he was prisoner of war and came back a year and a half later, and then almost immediately divorced my mother. So I grew up without his presence. I wouldn't say it was a move against an overwhelming father figure. He was simply not there. But at the age of 14, there was a time of extremely lucid moments that I had. I had a very intensive religious urge, and I started to travel on foot. I walked all around the country Albania, always following its borderline. That's exactly Kosovo, where there's all this turmoil right now. But I was only 14 and a child. And at that time, I knew and I decided that my destiny inevitably was to be a poet, or be the one who had to make the images, who had to make the films. And I shouldered all this very, very clearly, knowing that it would not be an easy life.
Now, I've read about this walk around Albania when you were a teenager, and I can't say I really understand what motivated you to do something so both extreme and in some ways pointless.
No, it was not pointless, certainly not at that time. And whenever I have traveled on foot, and I've traveled very, very large distances, mm-hmm. It always would have a very intensive, essential reason in my life.
What was the reason with Albania?
It was a deep mystery. There was, in the middle of Europe, a white dot on the map, a country that was totally inaccessible. It was like Tibet in the 50s or 40s, where nobody was allowed to go in. Visas were denied to everyone. And also some sort of a heritage. My mother's family comes from the Balkans. They were actually Croatians. So there were deep reasons behind all these things. I can give you an example which is easier to understand. When I wanted to marry and have children, I could have done it over the phone to propose, or I could have written a letter and propose, or I could have taken a car. But I had the feeling a real man walks to his woman and proposes and asks the questions. And so I crossed the Alps and I walked about 1,000 miles and knocked at the door of my future wife. And in this case, I actually told her that I had come on foot because I had one question to ask, so I asked it. And I think that was the right way to do it. So there was a very existential reason for it.
Werner Herzog, I'd love to talk more. We're out of time. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Werner Herzog speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. His new film, Rescue Dawn, is a dramatic retelling of the story from his 1997 documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly.